This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's time for Law and Behold, our ongoing series aimed at improving constitutional literacy among Malaysians, done in collaboration with the Malaysian Bar and the University of Malaya's Faculty of Law. So, former Prime Minister Datuk Sri Najib Razak was sentenced by the High Court to 12 years jail and fined 210 million ringgit after he was found guilty of all seven charges related to the misappropriation of 42 million ringgit of SRC International Fund. So what are the former Premier's rights to a fair trial appeal, and what is his position as an MP following his conviction? So we're going to be discussing this and more with Emeritus Professor Datuk Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi, a Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, and Firdaus Husni, the Chief Human Rights Strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights. Welcome both of you. How are you today?
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you both. You are both back in the studio. I cannot tell you how happy I am to see your lovely faces before me. But, you know, last Tuesday's ruling, that makes Datuk Sri Najib the first Malaysian leader to be convicted of corruption. Maybe you would like to just go through very briefly, you know, what he was convicted of and, you know, what his sentence is.
Okay, sure. So, this is only in relation to Tuesday's ruling, the SRC case. So you mentioned earlier 12 years of imprisonment. You know, some people might be wondering why 12 years. I thought we were looking at seven charges. Well, yes, seven charges. Three charges is for criminal breach of trust under the Penal Code, and that carries 10 years each. So that's 30 years. Three charges are under what is called the anti-money laundering, anti-terrorism financing and proceeds. So that's three charges, 10 years each. So 30 years, 30 years, and that's 60 years. And then 12 years under the Section 23 of MACC for abuse of power, you're looking at 12 years. So it's a total of 72 years. Why it's 12 years is because the ruling is for these sentences, the imprisonment, to be carried out concurrently as opposed to consecutively. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that is why it's 12 years and, yes, 210 million.
Okay, and, you know, let's address some questions that, you know, came up from the non-legal folks, you know, following the verdict announcement. So Datuk Sri Najib remained free as Judge Muhammad Nazlan Ghazali granted a stay order on the execution of Najib's sentence pending an appeal. So why is that necessary? I mean, why is it necessary to have a stay order?
Okay, in some countries, for example, the UK, USA, Canada, New Zealand, in general, once a person is convicted, that is, convicted means found guilty, then even if he appeals, he has to serve his sentence first. For example, Bill Cosby in the US, he was appealing, but while appeal is pending, he served his sentence. Jeffrey Epstein was found guilty, and he was serving his sentence when he's supposed to have killed himself. So in most countries, there is no stay. People have to go to jail if they have been convicted. Bail is when a person is charged, normally. Of course, there are non-bailable offenses, but generally. However, in our country, we have to admit to that under the Criminal Procedure Code and the Courts of Judicature Act, clearly the judge has a discretion. Mm-hmm. An appeal does not operate as an automatic stay except as to whipping. Whipping will be stayed automatically. That's what Section 311 of the Criminal Procedure Code says. But when it comes to imprisonment, then the judge has discretion. I'll mention in a few minutes what's the basis on which he should exercise his discretion. On the issue of fine, normally fines are not stayed. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are clear-cut court cases which say fines should not be stayed. But the judge in this case stayed the fine also. So what are the considerations by the court which would persuade the court to stay the execution of the sentence. We must clarify, the conviction stands. The person now is no more accused. He's already a convict. But the sentence has been stayed in this case. I personally think that this discretion should exist in some circumstances. For example, if a person has been sentenced to death and he's appealing, surely you've got to stay the execution of the sentence till the appeal is heard. If in a case my house is to be ordered to be demolished, now surely if I'm appealing, then the order to demolish must be stayed so that there is no irreversible damage. But the considerations must be exceptional. There should be irreversible damage. There are many factors actually the courts take into consideration, and it's a very long chapter in the Criminal Procedure Code. My personal view is this, and I will rely on Firdaus also to make her opinion on this, to give her opinion. I personally think that this was not a case worthy of a stay of execution. If the sentence was only, let us say, 3 months, and the court said, no, it will not be stayed, that may be a little bit unfair because the appeal may take more than 3 months, mm-hmm. which means the appeal is of no use. But here the sentence is 12 years. So the court will definitely be able to finish the appeal within that time. Also, I think the offense was very grave here. Public office is a public trust. And in this case, evidence indicates there was a scandalous and massive breach of public trust. The amount involved was too huge. So I think public confidence in the administration of justice and in the notion of equality before the law required that in this case, judgment should have been enforced. But there is nothing illegal or improper in that the judge found exceptional circumstances. I remember reading that the lawyer for Dato' Sri Najib said that Dato' Sri Najib is facing many other cases, and it would prejudice his case, other cases, if he were not allowed a stay on this. I don't find that argument attractive, but I think that was the argument made. The gravity of the offense was very serious, and I'm afraid that in criminal cases of this sort, if you stay a judgment, that would encourage proliferation of appeals. People will right away appeal, even though the appeal may have no merit. Mm-hmm. And in this case also, from the evidence that we have heard, evidence is very, very strong against him. And I really don't think this was a case fit for stay of the execution. I think the more serious the sentence is, the greater temptation people would have to flee from the jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that he will do that, but nevertheless, that is one of the factors the judge must take note of. I also think, and this is my personal opinion, that in our legal system, perhaps in most legal systems, we tend to be biased against physical offenses, murder, rape. Well, we tend to be rather tolerant or lenient on economic offenses. And I think this is a very serious economic offense, looting of public funds. Public funds actually from organizations that were meant to serve the public. So I think the judge has a discretion. He has exercised it, but most respectfully, I think this was not a fit case for delaying the sentence.
Firdaus, anything you wanted to add to that?
A quick one and a short one. So yes, under our national law, an appeal cannot be automatically considered as a stay of execution. I think we need to make that clear, yes. To answer why is he still walking around when he's convicted and sentenced. So that's one. What Prof said is right. The test here, one, it's really the discretion of the judge upon application by the lawyer representing Datuk Sri. And to see whether or not special circumstances has been established. So from the news report that I read, that those were the grounds that the fine imposed was a hefty fine. That is one. And the 12 years was, you know, a very grave. It doesn't look at the grave offences. It looks at the grave gravity of the punishment. That's what the lawyer did. Saying that, oh, because he has other charges going on, other cases, this apparently would impinge on his right to defend himself. If we want to go further, whether or not he is going to be completely cut off from having effective legal representation, if he were to serve his sentence, to me, then that should be the yardstick here. Is he going to be cut off from legal representation if he were to run his sentences? So if we were to look at that, then there can be argument to what Prof said for the fact that this may not be exactly a special circumstances warranting a stay of execution. But having said that, I thought it's also prudent that the judge did put in conditions, by saying that he has to report every 1st and every 15th.
Yes.
So to me, that is one way to try to address the concerns when an execution is stayed, not just in this case with Datuk Sri Najib, but other cases as well.
Yeah, it's a matter of discretion, and discretion is subjective. One could disagree, but certainly the judge was very much in accordance with the law. Mm-hmm. Just that people may disagree on whether this was a case fit for exercise of discretion in favor of the convict.
I'm speaking today to Emeritus Professor Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi, a professor of constitutional law at University of Malaya, and Firdaus Husni, the chief human rights strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights. And we're discussing Dr. Sri Najib's rights, you know, post-conviction. And we're going to continue that discussion after this quick break. You're listening to Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It is our episode of Law and Behold, and today we are looking at the conviction of Datuk Sri Najib Razak, who was convicted and sentenced to 12 years jail and fined 210 million ringgit after he was found guilty of all 7 charges related to the misappropriation of 42 million ringgit. And this is, of course, with relation to the SRC International Fund. So before the break, we were talking about, you know, the whether it was necessary to have a stay order. But, you know, following his verdict as well, his lawyer, who we've been talking about, Tan Sri Muhammad Shafi Abdullah, he said that, you know, the judge, while he believes it was an honest judgment and the judge himself was honest, he believed that that Justice Nazlan honestly made various mistakes. So some people were curious, you know, could that be construed as criticizing the judge? And if so, can that be considered as contempt of court?
Justice must be allowed to suffer the scrutiny of reasonable men and women. And I think we should not apply the law of contempt too severely. There should be maximum possible scope for exercise of freedom of speech. It's not a contempt of court, in my opinion, to disagree with the judge's interpretation of the law, to say that the judge may have overlooked some aspects of the law. But if one were to accuse the judge of bias or malice, or in language which is too disrespectful to say the judge is in such and such, then that would amount to contempt, I think. The concept of contempt is very, very broad. Contempt can be civil, contempt can be criminal, but basically it's a broad definition in the sense that you should not bring the whole system of justice into disrepute. Mm-hmm. Besides the judge, you should not bring the system of justice into disrepute. You should not obstruct justice like threatening a witness or threatening the judge or threatening the lawyer. So many, many ways, actually. So coming back to your issue, for the lawyer concerned to say the judge honestly made some honest mistakes, I don't think that amounts to contempt. It may be disrespectful indeed, but I don't think it's contempt.
Okay, but you know, in what other situation, in this case in particular, what might be construed as or considered as, you know, contempt of court?
Well, if I may just give one example, I understand that the person involved, that is Dato Sri Najib, is supposed to have made a statement that he hopes to get a fairer trial under the PN government. Now, that implies that the judges under the former Pakatan government were politically motivated. I would think that if this statement, and I wish to emphasize, if this statement is correct, if this allegation is correct, that would be contempt. So accusing the judge of bias or accusing the judge of being under the thumb of the then government clearly is bias. I also saw a video today, and I think the video is clearly on the borderline of contempt. Of course, it will be for the judge to decide where the allegations are. I just gave money for the poor and for the anak yatim, and I'm being punished for that. Now, I know there is no direct insinuation the judge is biased or the judge is not intelligent enough. But really, for the general public, this means the judge doesn't know what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's also misleading because in law, it is not a defense to be a Robin Hood. A person may steal from the supermarket to feed the poor.
That's right.
But that is still a crime. And to say the judge, you know, doesn't, I was feeding the poor and you are punishing me. I think that borders on accusing the judge of gross incompetence, mm-hmm. of gross indifference to the facts. And I think that's not a fair statement because, as I said, your motive may be very noble. Bota Chin may have noble motives. Robin Hood had noble motives. Maybe. We don't know the facts, but it's not fair to make allegations of that sort.
There was also, I guess, news, unverified news, or rather message that was going around, either on social media or the messaging services, essentially alleging some sort of family relations between between
That's
the judge and certain political leaders. To me, that goes not... I mean, of course, you know, directly or rather expressly, it's talking about the judge. But on the whole, it actually paints a very disreputable picture of the judiciary as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself is scandalizing the judiciary.
Yes, so, I would agree with that.
Yeah. So to me, that is, you know, a dangerous case that is going into contempt of court in itself.
Yeah. This is the problem, Juliet, of freedom of speech. This is abuse of freedom of speech. Yeah. But because of the social media, this is good. This is on social media, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why I heard social media and social media. WhatsApp, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, and just going on, you know, freedom of speech, you know, you mentioned Dato Sri Najib, you know, making his videos and things like that. I mean, that's also part of his freedom of speech, I suppose.
Well, it's an abuse of freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is subject to limitations. Defamation is one of them. Public order, national security, incitement to an offense, friendly relations with other states, contempt of court, contempt of parliament, defamation, morality. 8 grounds under Article 10, Clause 2. There are about 8 other grounds in other laws, but... freedom per se has no value.
Mm-hmm.
It's what freedom is for. It's the use to which it is put. It's the sense of responsibility and restraint with which it is exercised. Freedom has to go hand in hand with responsibility. Nobody has freedom under the law to lie and to mislead and to put the judiciary in such a bad light. And given the fact that the person who is doing it was a former prime minister, possibly the most powerful man in the country. And with then social media at his disposal and money at his disposal, I think this is a clear attempt at discrediting the entire judicial system. And that's not right.
I'd just like to add two things on contempt of court. One, the test here should be, yes, you know, everyone is accorded freedom of expression in this country under Article 10 of the Federal Constitution. But does that criticism exceed reasonable criticism, exceed, you know, facts that's out there? So that's one. And second, it's important to also note that contempt of court, it's not for the judge to punish. It's not to, you know, on the judge personal reputation, but it is essentially for the courts to uphold its reputation and ultimately maintain public's confidence in the integrity of the courts. That is why we have this common law of contempt of court.
May I just add there that actually, besides words, deeds will also be regarded as contempt. For example, you... as we mentioned earlier, you threaten a witness or you deliberately hide information from the courts. You lie to the court. So actually, word or deed that interferes with the administration of justice. There's a witness who is going to appear, you kidnap him. Or you hide him, lock him up. Or you challenge the dignity of the court. Or you challenge the independence of the court. Any challenge to the authority and dignity of the judicial process, any words or acts or publication that are calculated to bring a judge into disrepute or to lower his authority, to say the judge did not take note that I was helping the poor, or to interfere with the due course of justice or the lawful process of the courts, I think that's contempt.
Okay, and... you know, just going again on what his lead counsel Shafi said, you know, he said that he was happy actually that the High Court found Dato' Sri Najib guilty of all seven charges, adding that it would give them a better chance in the appeal process. Could you walk me through that, you know, the whole appeals process? You know, what are his options to appeal?
Okay, so essentially, upon conviction and the sentence sentencing, Dato' Sri Najib has 14 days to appeal. And so we can talk about how this relates to his, you know, qualification, disqualification of MP later. Yeah, but essentially, as long as he files his appeal within 14 days, then and file his application for stay. Yeah, so so now he can appeal against his conviction, one, against his sentence, two. So these are, you know, two, you could say, separate matters, yeah, for appeal. And of course, as now his stay of execution has been granted, he is not serving any of the 12 years, any of the 210 million fine. It's not, he doesn't have to pay any of that. And so when we talk about that, the appeal process here is that he will basically look, it's not a matter of, unless there is special circumstances, he cannot really adduce new evidence, for example.
Okay.
Yeah. So it will be based on what has been reiterated in the court of first instance. So in this case, the High Court. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's what he needs to look at.
Okay.
And so it can be an example of a point of law that the High Court decides wrongly, erred in his judgment. Maybe that was what, you know, Dato' Sri Najib's lawyer was referring to, for example. It can also be a judgment which was decided in error in terms of a determination of fact, which leads to, you know, the conviction. So it can be that as well. So these are the factors to be looked at, not factors that are unrelated at the time of the first proceedings.
Okay.
Yeah, so these are what we are looking at for the appeal process. There isn't, in the rules of court, there isn't a specific timeline. Are we looking at, oh, it has to be disposed within 2 years, 3 years? But I think the court has established KPI in light of, you know, backlog of cases. Usually, if there's, you know, if there's a case file, if there's an appeal, unless there's you know, they are acceptable reason. Usually, they would try to have it disposed within 9 months, up to a year.
Mm. Okay, all right. I think because a lot of people were wondering if this could drag on for years. You know, that was a question that was coming out. You know, how long could this be dragged on?
So basically,
for?
Actually, on appeal, several alternative scenarios are possible. he could be found not guilty of all charges, mm-hmm. acquitted completely. Or he could be found guilty of some, not guilty of other charges, because there are actually...
Seven charges.
There are seven charges. And the lawyer will take up each charge one by one. It's not a everything holistically coming together. No, each charge one by one. So he could be found guilty of some and not guilty of others. Or the court may find him guilty of all the charges, but the court may vary the sentence. Now, when I say vary, I mean both increase or decrease. It doesn't necessarily mean that on appeal it will be decreased. It could be increased. And of course, don't forget there are two sentences here. One is a jail of 12 years and one is a sentence of 210. So the court could vary either of these. So the possibilities for the appeal court are many indeed. But I don't think the appeal court is going to take 3 years or so, no. I think this decision, probably in light of its public importance, my guess is we can expect this appeal to come on fairly soon and probably be decided within the year. But then don't forget, there is a further appeal to the federal court, isn't it?
Yes, that is true.
There's right. a further appeal to the federal court.
Okay, so we could be, this could probably go on till at least next year or...
I mean, if he fails to appeal, for example, say the Court of Appeal decided to dismiss his appeal, and then he failed to appeal within 14 days, then his right of appeal ended there.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
But at the moment, I think conviction was on Tuesday. He filed his appeal on Thursday. So that is well within time.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And just speaking about that, you know, Article 48, 1E of the Federal Constitution states that MPs are disqualified if convicted of an offence and sentenced to a jail term of more than 1 year and fined more than 2,000 ringgit, and if they have not received a quote-unquote free pardon. So does a conviction in the High Court disqualify an MP if he appeals?
No, the law as it stands, and I'll say a little bit about how I think the law is in need of amendment. The law as it stands is that if a person is convicted, sentenced to imprisonment for 1 year or more, or fined 2,000 ringgit or more, then if he appeals, appeal definitely operates as a stay of any disqualification, mm-hmm. as long as he's appealing. And even if he loses the appeal, the conviction is upheld, he still has another alternative, and that is to apply for pardon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And while the pardon application is pending, he's still an MP. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes pardon application take a long time. So he's an MP while the appeal is pending. He's an MP. Or within 14 days, he must, of course, apply for pardon if he's still convicted. While the pardon application has not been disposed of, he's still an MP. So the law in this respect actually is rather unusual. A person in a public office with a public trust is found guilty of a heinous criminal offence, and yet actually he continues to remain as an MP. If you look at the law as a whole, you notice bankrupts under 48 clause 1 sub clause B. In bankruptcy, there is no necessary criminal intention. A person may become a bankrupt because of COVID-19, his business collapsed. Mm-hmm. But if he's a bankrupt, well then, unless he is a discharged bank, unless he discharges his bankruptcy, he loses his seat. If an MP fails to lodge his election return, that disqualifies him from being, and he's convicted of that offence and jailed for 1 year or more, he loses his seat. So the point I'm trying to make is this, that for minor, non-serious, non-heinous offences, a person can lose his seat. Mm. But in a case like that, the law says that as long as you're appealing or you have not been pardoned, you can continue in your office. And if an MP resigns from his seat, resigns, Article 48, Clause 6 says he cannot contest for Parliament for the next few years. So the law actually is a little bit unfair in the sense that it creates the bad impression. Wakil Rayat has been found guilty by a court. Then I think he should be required to pay the price rather than still continue to be a member of our August Assembly of Parliament. So that's the way the law is.
Anything you wanted to add to that, Firdaus?
Well, yes, when you look at Article 48, if you know any of the listeners want to know more, just Article 48 actually sets out, you know, the whole procedures. There was also some questions on whether or not that matter of on disqualification should be a matter decided by the parliament. But
yeah,
no, because when it is a conviction by court falling under 48(1)(e), then no, that should is not a matter for deliberation of parliament at all. And I do see a point that Prof made earlier. You're talking about the August House. You're talking about lawmakers, people making law. And this is one of the important, most important agency of the government. And so there is, certain standard that we must uphold when you talk about the lawmakers representing the interests of the nation. Mm-hmm. So to me, Article 48, yes, as it stands, that's how it is. He is not disqualified as an MP.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are talking about the next election, no, that's a separate question.
Okay. And that was my next question. You know, what does this mean, you know, for his eligibility to contest in future elections?
His disqualification is immediate.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that upon his conviction, then he is disqualified from running also the 5 years period.
5 years actually after he has served his sentence.
Yes.
After the 12 years.
From the date of his release of that 12 years,
mm-hmm.
5 years after that, then only he can run for the next election. So if let's say if we were to relate this to the situation with Anwar,
mm-hmm.
That was why even after his release, he missed 102 general election before he can actually run.
Yeah, may I just add to that? There is also the element of pardon. Even if Dato Sri Najib's conviction is not overturned, he could still apply for a pardon.
Mm-hmm.
And in the light of the fact that he was the former prime minister, we never know. But maybe the wisdom of the Pardons Board
mm-hmm.
and of the Yang Di Pertuan.
And assuming an MP loses his appeal at the federal court, would he be automatically disqualified?
14 days after he, unless he has secured a pardon.
Okay, unless the pardon. So he's lost his appeal. He didn't get a pardon. Then only he would be disqualified.
Yeah, 14 days, I think. 14 days. 14 days.
Okay, all right. So, and I think, another question on a lot of people's mind is whether this conviction will stick, you know, if Dato Sri Najib's political future is over. Do you think he could receive a royal pardon should his appeal fail?
Actually, that's very speculative because I think their majesties definitely have the power to pardon. But nevertheless, I'm sure they'll take into consideration the seriousness of the charges that are coming out. And please do bear this in mind that what we have seen in the SRC case is just one case.
Mm-hmm.
A few others pending.
That's right.
The total amount involved is huge. And there are allegations of tampering with the Auditor General's report. And there are many other such charges. So this is a nightmare. Both for him and his family and in some respects for our nation's reputation. We will continue to be hounded with this reputation of being a kleptocratic nation for a very long time to come.
That's right. And, that is something else I wanted to ask you. You know, what are the implications, both positive and negative, you know, for the nation, of this verdict?
Okay, now that's, before I talk about that, let me just mention this to you, Juliet, that today all three of us here are not here to step on a fallen figure, isn't it?
No.
We are here to reflect on our system of justice as it worked in this infamous SRC case. And more optimistically, we are here to learn from the horrendous disclosures of this case and to see what can be done or should be done to heal our broken system. But that would have to be done at some other future session. But right away, the implications very quickly would be this. I think for the judiciary, this verdict pronounced by the learned judge paints the judiciary in a favorable light. Justice Muhammad Mazlan Ghazali represents the face of a rejuvenated judiciary strengthened by the leadership of Tan Sri Richard Malanjan and now Tan Sri Tengku Maimoon. So I think it's good for the judiciary that the judiciary can resist all the political pressures, the demonstrations outside, which itself, in my personal view, almost amounts to contempt by those who are organizing it, trying to pressurize the judiciary. However, on the sad side, on the negative side, this whole sad case indicates that we have a lot of systems that have broken down. Parliament is supposed to be the grand inquest of the nation. It is supposed to keep the executive answerable, accountable, responsible. Obviously, it failed to do so. Even the Parliament's Public Accounts Committee was totally ineffective. Most of its members were recruited into the executive branch, and therefore the Public Accounts Committee totally collapsed. Mm. It was unable to function. What is very, very sad indeed is that people's funds, like in KWAP, were being employed for purposes other than taking care of the retirees. People today will now wonder whether Petronas or EPF or Tabung Haji or Felda or Mara or MOF Incorporated, whether these can be trusted to safeguard the nation's purse. A very, very shocking and sad realization is this, that for our elections, foreign countries can give us massive funds. Mm-hmm. So that's very funny. When it comes to you and I contesting, there are ceilings beyond which we cannot spend money. Oh, but the ruling party can receive supposedly 42 million or more ringgit from a foreign head of state. Now, how does this affect the integrity of our electoral process? How does this affect our foreign policy? It is perhaps a coincidence that Malaysia sent its forces, armed forces, to take part in the genocidal and fratricidal war in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia is actually Saudi Arabia is involved in that war, and the donation came from Saudi Arabia supposedly, and we are sending our soldiers there. So all these implications for our nation are frightening. But I just hope that there is now only one way to move, and that is to go up. We have fallen so low. We have fallen so low in all these areas. We have institutions that have broken down. I hope the only way now is to go up. And I do hope and pray that the present government, despite all its other political challenges, I hope it can keep the agenda for reform still in line.
Well, okay. So my message, or rather what I think, before that, what are the implications here of the conviction and the sentencing? First of all, if I can share, when the conviction and sentencing was first reported, someone I know actually said, you know what, we shouldn't be surprised because, you know, all of them are involved in corruption in one way or another, small sum, big sum, probably just, you know, not disclosed for some. To me, that's a very sad reflection of the perception that the public has on our elected leaders. And that needs to change. That cannot be accepted as an open secret. What is that even? So that's one. And second, I would like to link this back to what Prof said at the early part of this interview, where he said we are, you know, we as people are tolerant of economic crimes. I mean, we should be thinking how much that 42 million, and I'm only talking about this case, 42 million, right, can be used to develop the country. How much can it could have prospered if it were to be invested properly? How many Malaysians can actually benefit from that? So, to me, what has happened, and not just with the SRC cases, the whole scandal, the whole corruption scandal involving Datuk Sri Najib has, you know, has been an international scandal, you know. Even the all the way to the US, they have also been involved in looking into this scandal. And what the conviction and the sentencing has done here last Tuesday, to me, it's not just to send a message to the nation that we don't tolerate economic crimes, but we are also sending a message internationally to the world that we are not a nation that tolerate corruption. And to me, that's good.
Yes, yeah. Indeed.
Okay. All right. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dr. Shahd Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and Firdaus Husni, the chief human rights strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights. And we were discussing, well, Dato' Sri Najib's rights, you know, post-conviction and what might happen, you know, following his guilty verdict. If you miss any part of the interview or any previous Law and Behold interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.